Liana hovered off the grill on the far side of the compartment. She flashed a smile that broadcast welcome and apology in equal measure.
Dan Brooks, Rakshi Sengupta.
Brooks took another look around the dome. Valerie.
Won't be joining us, Liana said.
Fixing her arm, Sengupta added. Thank Christ.
So,
Moore began, clearly eager to cut to the chase now that the straggler had arrived.
What was it?
Sengupta rolled her eyes.
What do you think? They burned through the felching spoke. It was an attack.
Who? Brooks wondered, and held his tongue.
I was hoping for a bit more detail, Moore said mildly, unfazed.
Liana obliged. Basically, they turned a magnifying glass on us.
Focused microwave pulse, about half a gigawatt, judging by the damage.
From where?
Moore asked. Liana bit her lip.
Sun, northern hemisphere.
That's it?
Even bicams have limits, Jim. It's pure hindsight. Differential heat stress on different facets of the structure. Spoke trajectory. Basically, they just back-calced how the different parts were lined up at the time, figured a bearing from the angle of the hit.
Could have done that ourselves, Sengupta grumbled. Who? Brooks blurted out. Who hit us? Nobody spoke. Sengupta regarded something in his general direction, the way she might examine a bit of fecal matter scraped off her boot.
That's what we're trying to figure out, Liana said after a moment.
Moore pursed his lips.
So the hive didn't see it coming.
She shook her head, as if reluctant to admit to the shortcoming out loud.
Tran, then.
It'd be one for the books if a baseline caught them with their pants down.
Moore's eyes flickered to stern.
Under normal circumstances, certainly. They're not exactly operating at 100%.
Gray icons clustered in the hold. Brooks cleared his throat. What are they doing back there exactly?
Convalescing, Liana said. Bug hit them a lot harder than it hit us. We've pumped up the pressure to speed their recovery, but it'll still be days.
So after the break?
Moore mused.
Break?
Liana nodded.
We'll have to boot up at least a week early on the other end. They want the option of going hands-on.
Hands-on where? Brooks wondered. What break? Sengupta cut him off with an exasperated whistle through clenched teeth. Turned to Liana.
Didn't I tell you?
If you could hold on to your questions for the moment, Moore suggested, I'll be happy to fill you in later.
When you won't be wasting everyone else's time, Sengupta added.
Rock, Liana began.
Why is he even here? Does anyone expect him to actually do anything other than feel included?
Is that what I'm feeling? Brooks remarked.
It's not exactly Dan who's wasting our time right now, Liana pointed out.
Sengupta snorted. Moore waited a beat before getting back to business.
Are there any weapons that could do this from that range?
Liana shrugged.
You're the spook. You tell me.
I'm not talking about baseline tech.
This doesn't look like a dedicated weapon. More likely, someone hijacked a bunch of power sats to fire simultaneously at the same spot. Probably a one-shot deal, too. You don't get that kind of output by staying inside the rated specs. Probably blew the circuits across the whole network. Maybe even past their healing threshold.
Wouldn't matter anyway with a 12-minute lag. They had one chance to anticipate our position, and they blew it.
Rakshi, our... Quarter-second thruster squirts, random intervals between 6 and 12 minutes. You won't even feel them, but those fuckers won't be forecasting me again.
12-minute light-speed lag, Brooks reflected, from the sun and back. So we're 6 light-minutes from the sun, which puts us 108 million kilometers, close as Venus if he remembered his basic astronomy.
Impact our tipping point?
Moore was asking.
Liana nodded. But not enough to matter. They're working through the revisions now. Another couple of hours, they say.
And what about our tail?
Sengupta painted invisible strokes in the air. A window opened on the dome. Some kind of plasma plot. Three red spikes erupting from a landscape of violet foothills. The details wobbled in real time, but those peaks stayed constant. Up in one corner, arcane annotations nattered on about discriminant complex and infrared occlusion and microlensing. Heat prints of some kind, Brooks guessed. Cloaked, judging from the annotations. But apparently Sengupta had magic fingers. They were being followed. This just keeps getting better.
So, Moore considered, two prongs or two players?
Prongs, probably. The bicams think the shot was meant to disable us enough to let them catch up.
Liana hummed. I wondered why they didn't just throw a missile at us.
Sengupta.
Maybe they will now their big tripwire went kaput.
We could use that, Moore mused. Rakshi, how much warning would we get if they fired on us?
Fired what? You want the whole catalog?
Standard asscracker. Ballpark's fine.
She wiggled her fingers, for all the world as if she were counting on them. 7 hours, 8 minutes if the range doesn't change. Give or take.
Then we better get started, Moore said.
That is easily the most unenlightening briefing I have ever attended, Brooks grumbled, pulling himself back into the Southern Hemisphere. And given the number of departmental committees I sit on, that's saying something.
Yeah, I kind of got that.
Liana looked back from a bulkhead handhold.
Come with me. Got something that might help.
She turned like a fish and sailed through the nearest spokeway. The very sight made Brooks a bit queasy. He followed at his own awkward pace, back through the cube-infested Southern Hemisphere, into the ball and socket that had swallowed her. Liana dropped easily ahead of him, fending off Coriolis with a push and a kick. She was 10 meters down the spoke before she even grabbed a hoop. Fuck those acrobatics. Brooks grabbed his own hoop right off the top, swung around, and fumbled his foot into another before he weighed more than a couple of kilograms. He couldn't be bothered to work out the acceleration of free-falling bodies that gained weight with each meter, but down the length of the spoke, he was pretty sure they all ended in splat. Commons. Another hab identical to those he kept escaping. A 2-level propane tank from his grandfather's backyard barbecue, grown monstrous and pumped full of stale air. The upper level, at least, was less crowded than repair and maintenance. Chairs, privacy screens, a half-dozen half-emptied cubes, a table, the usual bands of epiphytic astroturf, a framework of pencil-thin scaffolding extended from one wall. The facets of a personal tent, bone yellow, tough as tendons, stretched like latex between those vertices. A couple of sticky chairs faced each other amid the clutter. Liana was over by the fabber, rummaging through a freshly popped cube.
Got it.
The cowl she held up looked a little like a bondage hood for plumbing fetishists, studded with washers and tiny screws that traced a fine grid across the skull. It left only the lower face exposed, mouth, jaw, the tip of the nose. Two especially prominent washers sat embedded over the eyes. Ambient superconductors, compressed ultrasound pingers, a read-write voxel array in black leather.
My old gaming mask, Liana announced. I thought you could use an interface a little more user-friendly than Rakshi tends to be.
A gimp hood. For cripples confined to meat space.
I mean, since you don't have the imp...
Thanks, Brooks said. I think I'll stick with the smart paint if it's all the same to you.
It's not just for gaming, Liana assured him. It's perfectly transparent for consensus, and it's way faster than going through the paint. Plus, it'll triple your assimilation rate over anything filtered through the senses. Perfect for porn. Whatever you like.
She closed the cube.
There's really not much of anything it can't do.
He took it from her. The material felt faintly oily in his hands. He turned it over, read the little logo that hovered a virtual centimeter off its surface. Interloper accessories.
It's completely non-invasive, Liana told him. All TMS and compressed ultrasound. Even the opt-
I'm familiar with the tech, he told her. And then, thanks. And you know, if you ever are in the mood for gaming, I'm happy to buddy up. No mention of his helplessness at Valerie's hands. No mention of his panic attack. No impatience with his ignorance. No condescension over his lack of augments. Just an overture and a helping hand. Brooks tasted a mixture of shame and gratitude. I like this woman, he thought. Thanks, he said again, because he didn't know anything else that fit. She flashed a goofy smile. Anytime, and pointed to something past his shoulder. I think Jim wanted a word, right? Brooks turned. Moore had dropped soundlessly onto the deck behind him. Now he stood there, looking vaguely apologetic, the web sack on his back bulging with curves and odd angles.
Should I?
I gotta get back to the hold anyway. He's all yours. Liana vanished into the ceiling with a jump and a grab, while Moore shrugged the sack off his shoulders and split the seal. Brooks watched him withdraw a roll of the same kind of webbing. Moore held it out.
For humping gear.
Brooks took it after a moment. Thanks. Don't seem to have brought much gear with me. But the colonel was already back in his rucksack. This time he extracted a long green bottle, turned it in his hands so Brooks could see the label. Glenmorangie.
Found it in one of the cubes, he said. Don't ask me how it got there. Maybe it was some kind of retailer's bonus for a big order. Maybe Chinadoom just wanted to give me a doggy treat. All I know is it's a personal favorite.
He set it on the deck, reached back into the sack.
And it came with a nice set of glasses.
He gestured to the sticky chairs.
Pull up a seat.
Moore cracked the bottle. The smell of peat and wood smoke swirled in the air.
Technically, we shouldn't be playing with open liquids even at 1/3 G. But squeeze bulbs make everything taste like plastic.
Brooks held out his glass.
If I had to guess.
Moore let a wobbling, low-gravity dram escape from the bottle.
I'd say you're feeling a bit pissed off.
Maybe, Brooks admitted, when I'm not crapping my pants with existential terror.
One day you're minding your own business on your camping trip.
Field research.
The next, you're in the crossfire of a Tran war. The day after that, you wake up on a spaceship with a bullseye painted on its hull.
I do wonder what I'm doing here. Every 30 seconds or so. They clinked and swallowed. Brooks grunted appreciatively as the liquid set the back of his throat to smoldering.
There's a risk in being here, certainly, Moore admitted. And for that, I apologize. On the other hand, if we hadn't taken you with us, you'd most likely be dead already.
Do we even know who's chasing us?
Not with any certainty. Could be any number of parties, even cavemen.
The colonel sipped his drink.
Sometimes Liana doesn't give us enough credit.
But why? A thought occurred to him. The Hive didn't steal this thing, did they? Moore chuckled.
Do you know how many basic patents the Order has its name on? They could probably buy a fleet of these ships out of petty cash if they wanted to.
Then why?
The Hive was classified as a threat, rightly, even when it was stuck in a desert at the bottom of the well. Now we're on a ship that can take us anywhere from Icarus to the O'Neills.
He regarded his scotch.
The threat level isn't going anywhere but up.
That where we're going? Icarus? Moore nodded.
I don't think our tail knows that yet. For all they know, we could be cutting across the Inersis on our way somewhere else. Probably why they've held back as long as they have.
He drained his glass.
Why's a sticky word, though. It's not especially productive to think of them as agents with agendas. Better to think of them as very complex interacting systems, just doing what systems do. Whatever the reagents tell themselves to explain their role in the reaction, it's not likely to have much to do with the actual chemistry.
Brooks looked at the other man with new eyes. You some kind of Buddhist, Jim?
A Buddhist soldier.
Moore smiled and refilled their glasses.
I like that.
Was Icarus part of the magnifying glass?
Not likely. Can't rule it out, though. It's in the confidence zone.
So why are we going there?
There's that word again.
Moore set his glass down on the nearest cube.
Recon, basically.
Recon.
The bicamerals would think of it as more of a pilgrimage, I suppose.
His mouth tightened at one corner, a small, lopsided grimace.
You remember the Theseus mission?
It was too rhetorical for a question mark.
Of course. You know the fueling technology it used. Uses.
Brooks shrugged. Icarus cracks the antimatter, lasers out the quantum specs, Theseus stamps them onto its own stockpiles, boom, all the antiprotons you can eat.
Close enough. What matters is that Icarus has been beaming fuel specs up to Theseus's telematter drive for over a decade now. And lately, there's been some suggestion that something else has been coming down along the same beam.
Wouldn't you expect them to send back samples?
Theseus's fab channel went to a quarantine facility in LEO. I'm talking about the actual telematter stream.
I didn't know that was even possible, Brooks said.
Oh, it's quite possible. It was part of the design, in fact. Fuel up, data down. Of course, the state of the art's still light years away from being able to handle complex structure. The receivers for very basic stuff. Individual particles, exotic matter, non-baryonic even. Stuff that might take a lot of energy to build.
Brooks sipped and swallowed. What the hell were you expecting to find out there?
We had no idea.
Moore shrugged.
Something alien, obviously. And the cost of sticking a condenser on the sun side was negligible next to the mission as a whole. At the very least, they could use it for semaphore if the main channel went down. So they stuck one in case it proved useful.
Which I'm guessing it did, Brooks said. Moore eyed the empty glass at his side, as if weighing the wisdom of having set it down. After a moment, he reached for the bottle.
Here's the thing, he said, refilling his glass. Theseus got decoyed en route. Did you know that? Did they ever make that public?
Brooks shook his head. There was something about course corrections out past Jupiter. New and better data coming down the pike.
I can never keep it straight anymore, Moore growled. What we've admitted, what we've massaged, what we've covered up completely. But yes, after Firefall, we were all staring at the sky so hard our eyeballs bled. Found something beeping out in the Kuiper Belt. That much you know. Sent a squad of high G probes to check it out. Sent Theseus afterward, soon as we could slap her together. But she never made it that far. The probes got there first, caught a glimpse of something buried in a comet just before it blew up. All that way to get suckered by a decoy, as far as anyone could tell. Glorified landmine with a squawk box bolted on top. So we went back to our radio maps and our star charts, and we found an X-ray spike buried in the archives, years before Firefall, and never repeated. IAU called it an instrument glitch at the time, but now it's all we've got to go on. Theseus is already 15 AUs out and headed the wrong way. But you know, that's the great thing about an unlimited fuel supply. We feed her a new course, and she spins around and heads into the Oort, and she finds something out there. Tiny brown dwarf, it looks like. She goes in for a look, finds something in orbit, starts to send back details, and psst.
He splayed the fingers of his free hand, brought them together at the tips, spread them again, as if blowing out a candle.
Gone.
I didn't know that, Brooks said after a while.
I'd be worried if you did.
I thought the mission was still en route. Nothing on any of the feeds about finding anything. Brooks eyed his own glass. So what was it?
We don't know.
But if they'd started sending...
Multiple contacts. Thousands. There was some evidence they might have been seeding the dwarf's atmosphere with prebiotic organics. Some kind of super Jovian terraforming project, perhaps. But if they ever followed that up, we never heard about it.
Jesus, Brooks whispered.
Maybe something else in there, too,
Moore added, staring at the deck, staring through it, staring all the way out to the Ord itself.
Something hidden. Nothing definitive.
He didn't seem to be entirely in the room. Brooks softly cleared his throat. Moore blinked and came back.
That's all we know, really. The telemetry was noisy at best. That dwarf has one mother of a magnetic field. Shouts over anything you try to send out. The bicamerals have some amazing extraction algorithms. They were squeezing data out of clips I swore were nothing but static. But there are limits. Theseus went in and it was like watching a ship vanish into a fog bank. For all we know, she could still be sending. They left a relay sat behind at least. It's still active. As long as there's hope, we'll keep the feed going. But we're not getting anything back from the ship itself. Can't even get a signal through that soup.
Except you're getting a signal right now, you said. Coming in along...
No.
Moore held up his hand.
If the system was operating normally, we'd have seen it operating. And we didn't. No handshaking protocols, no explicit transmissions. Nobody from up there telling us they were sending something down here. None of the usual bells that are supposed to go off when a package arrives. At most, we got a little hiccup that suggests that something might have started coming down. But the checksums didn't pass muster, so move along, folks, nothing to see here. Mission Control didn't even notice it. I didn't notice it. Wasn't until the bicamerals helped me squeeze the archives through their born-again algorithms that I clued in, years after the fact.
But if the stream isn't even running its own protocols, how can it be...
Ask them!
Moore jerked his chin toward a vague point beyond the bulkhead, some nexus of bicameral insight.
I'm just along for the ride.
So something's using our telematter stream, Brooks said.
Or was, at least.
And it's not us.
And whatever it is, it's gone to great lengths to stay off the scope.
What would it be sending?
The angels of the asteroids,
Moore shrugged.
That's what the bicamerals are calling it. Or at least, that's our closest approximation. Probably just their idea of an opcode. But I don't know if they really think anything's down there. Maybe it's just a glitch after all. Or some kind of long-distance hack that didn't work out. And we can learn something about the hackers by studying their footprints.
Suppose there is something down there, though, Brooks said. Something physical. Moore spread his hands.
Like what? A clandestine mist of dissociated atoms?
I don't know. Something that breaks the rules.
Well, Moore said, in that case, I suppose.
He took a breath.
It's had a few years to settle in.
Things Fall Apart. William Butler Yeats. They'd come up with this really great plan to keep their mysterious pursuers from blowing up the crown. They were going to blow it up themselves first. They hadn't asked Brooks for his input. Now he was back in maintenance and repair, taping himself up with another rubbery exoskeleton. It was easy enough to lay down the bands. All he had to do was follow the denuded template he'd stripped into existence less than 2 days before. Of course, by now there were no days left to while away. Judging by the chime that had just sounded, he only had about 2 minutes to burn. 2 minutes to burn. Liana dropped out of the ceiling.
Hey, just so you know, rock's about ready to fold down the spokes. Didn't want you falling over when the gravity shifted.
Yeah, always concerned about the roaches, Brooks reflected wryly. That sounds just like Rakshi Sengupta. On cue, the bulkheads shivered. The hab trembled with the sudden faint roar of a distant ocean. A squeeze bulb rolled a few centimeters along the cube where someone had left it. Brooks swallowed. His knitting ankle itched maddeningly. He resisted the urge to scratch. It wouldn't help anyway. Not through the cast.
Nothing to worry about, Liana assured him. Right side up goes out of whack by a couple of degrees for a couple of minutes. Not even enough to spill your drink. If you were drinking.
He wished he was. Down edged out from between his feet like a lazy pendulum, came to rest half a meter off his center line. The crown's hollow bones folding back along the spine like the ribs of a closing umbrella. The spin that threw them out, slowing in a precise and delicate handoff to acceleration building from behind. All those thousands of tons in slow motion. All those vectors playing one against another. And Brooks could feel nothing but a brief, polite disagreement between his inner ears. Even now, down was edging back to where it belonged. It really was pretty impressive, he decided. Still, it's not the burn that bothers me. It's the coma afterward.
You won't even feel it.
That's what I mean. If I'm going to fall into the sun, I'd at least like to be awake enough to jump into an escape pod if things go south.
Then you've got nothing to worry about. No escape pods.
The hab jumped a bit, to the solid, omnipresent thud of great docking clamps snapping shut. The bulb on the table wobbled back and forth, the crown of thorns tied down and rigged for sail. She tossed him his jumpsuit, pointed to the ceiling.
Shall we go?
No effortless sail through a tunnel of light this time. No easing ascent from pseudograv into freefall. The crown was on fire now. Engines alight, habs flattened back against her flanks. There was no escape from mass time's acceleration. Every rung ascended left him heavy as the last. Each hoop of hazard tape left him with that much farther to fall. For some reason he couldn't identify. That almost made it easier. They emerged into the hub, into the bottom of a bowl, a place as gravity-bound now as any other on the ship. The great iris at the South Pole was fixed and dilated. Needles of mercury drooled from the mirror ball above like strings of gluey saliva, descending through the open pupil. Freight elevator, apparently. To the hold, and maybe beyond. To cubbies and crawl spaces, where circuits could be wrestled manually in the event of some catastrophic systems failure. To the colossal neutron-spewing engines themselves. Brooks edged forward and leaned over the railing. The depths of the crown's hollow spine receded like an optical illusion, like God's own trachea. Only 100 meters, Brooks reminded himself. Only 100 meters. Signs of activity down there. Flickers of motion. The faint clank of metal on metal. Liquid mirror ropes vibrating like bowstrings in response to whatever tugged at their ends. He jumped at a touch on his shoulder. Liana held 2 lengths of silver cord in her hand. A stirrup had miraculously opened at the end of each, like hypertrophic needle's eyes. She handed him 1 line, pointed her foot through the loop in the other. "Grab and jump," she said, stepping lightly onto the guardrail. She dropped away in slow motion. Under a quarter G burn, they weighed even less than under spin, and picked up speed with distance. Brooks hooked his own foot, grabbed his line with 1 hand, like wrapping your fingers around glassy rubber, and followed her down. The filament stretched and thinned in his grip as he descended. He raised his eyes and thought he might have glimpsed tiny shockwaves rippling out from the point at which this miracle cord extruded from the mirror ball's surface. But speed and distance robbed him of a second look. He dropped into pastel twilight, past biosteel struts and annular hoops, and padded iridescent bulkheads. Conduit bundles lined the throat like vocal cords, silvery metal streams blurred in passing. The end of Liana's discarded line snapped past, going the other way, recoiling back up the shaft like a frog's tongue. Only a quarter G. Still dead easy to break your neck at the bottom of 100 meters. But Brooks's descent was slowing now, his miracle bungee cord stretching to its limits. Another great hatch yawned just below, flanked by grills and service panels and a half dozen spacesuit alcoves. An airlock puckered the bulkhead to one side like a secondary mouth, big enough to swallow 2 of him whole. It was the larger mouth that took him, though. The silver cord lowered him through like a mother putting her baby to bed, dropped him gently from light into darkness. It set him down on the floor of a great dim cavern where monsters and machinery loomed on all sides, and abandoned him there. So this is strategy, Brooks mused. This is foresight. These are countermeasures. This is intellect so vast it won't even fit into language. This is suicide. Have faith, Liana had said dryly as they'd climbed into their suits. They know what they're doing. The spacesuit wrapped around him like an asphyxiating parasite. His breath and his blood rasped loud in his helmet. The nozzle up his ass twitched like a feeding proboscis. He couldn't feel the catheter in his urethra, which, in a way, was even worse. He had no way of knowing what it was doing in there. They know what they're doing. They'd spent the past 2 hours in the hold, lurking among the dim, tangled shadows of dismembered machine parts, while the rest of the ship froze down above them. Habs, labs, spines, and hub all pumped dry and opened to vacuum. Until a few hours ago, this cavernous space had been the exclusive domain of the afflicted bicamerals, an improvised hyperbaric chamber where enemy anaerobes withered in poisonous oxygen, where the hive could lick their wounds and incant whatever spells they used to assemble the pieces of the puzzle they were building. Now all that arcane proto-machinery was stacked and stored and strapped high against the walls. The bicamerals, their tissues still saturated under the weight of 15 atmospheres, had retreated into glass sarcophagi, personal decompression chambers with arms and legs. They stood arrayed on the deck, like the opposite of deep-sea divers from a bygone age, barely immobile. Valerie's zombies moved silently among them, apparently charged with their care, grubs tended by drones. Now the hold itself was freezing down, the crown's last pocket of atmosphere thinning around the assembled personnel. Bicamerals, baselines, monsters, those interstitial, indeterminate things who might be a little of each. They all stood watching as the flaccid pile of fabric in the center of the chamber unfolded into a great black sphere, some interlocking geodesic frame pushing out from under its skin like an extending origami skeleton, the hatching of a shadow. Moore had called it a thermos. Watching it inflate, Brooks was almost certain it was the same giant soccer ball that had carried them from the desert. New paint job, though. Liana bumped him from the side, touched helmets for a private word. Welcome to the Prineville class reunion. Brooks managed a smile in return. They know what they're doing. Brooks did, too, after a fashion. They were going to fall sideways. They were going to tumble past the exhaust, almost close enough to reach out and see your own arm vaporizing in a torrent of plasma blasting past at 25 kilometers per second. No option to fire maneuvering thrusters for a bit of extra forward momentum. No chance of putting a little distance between this soon-to-be-broken spine and the rapture of a half-dozen fusion bombs per minute. Newton's first was a real bitch, not open to negotiation. Not even the bicamerals could get her to spread her legs more than a crack, and even that grudging concession would be barely enough to mask the loss of their front end. There would be nothing left over for safe distancing maneuvers. And of course, if they didn't miscalculate by a micron or two, if this little sprig of struts and scaffolding didn't just get sucked into the wake and shredded to ions, well, maybe the barrage of neutrons sleeting out in all directions might be able to find a way in. Rakshi Sengupta reached up and popped the thermos's hatch. It sprang open and bumped back against the curve of the sphere, pneumatic and bouncy. Sengupta climbed up and in. Valerie's automatons, even more interchangeable now thanks to limited wardrobe options in the survival gear department, formed a line and began passing the bicamerals into that globe like worker ants carrying endangered eggs to safety. All aboard, Liana mouthed from behind her faceplate. It wasn't just the radiance of the drive that would give them away. Even the heat print of minimal life support would shine like a beacon against a cosmic background that barely edged above absolute zero. There were ways around that, of course. You don't notice a candle held up against the sun, and the crown of thorns had been keeping itself line of sight between Sol's edge and any pursuing telescopes. Close enough to bury her heat print in solar glare, not so close that she'd show up the moment someone threw an occlusion filter in front of their scanner. Another approach was to keep any warm bodies nested inside so much insulation that they'd be outside any reasonable search radius by the time their heat print made it to the surface. The bicamerals didn't like to take chances. They were doing both. It was the same soccer ball, all right. Same webbing inside, same ambiance. Victorian whorehouse red, he thought with a grimace. Shadows and wavelengths long enough to make even a corpse look pretty. Same company, with edits. A clutch of umbilicals hung from an overhead plexus and spread throughout the webbing. Brooks grabbed the nearest and locked it into his helmet's octopus socket. Liana reached down from overhead, double-checked the connection, gave him a thumbs up. Brooks sacked calm and whispered a thank you over the chorus of quiet breathing that flooded his helmet. Liana smiled back behind tinted glass. Moore climbed into the womb and sealed the hatch as the long wave dimmed around them. By the last of the light, Brooks saw the soldier reach for his own umbilical. Then, darkness swallowed them all. Valerie was in here too, hidden inside one of these mercurial disguises. Brooks hadn't seen her enter, hadn't even seen her on the deck. But then again, she could do that. She had to be in here somewhere, maybe in that suit, or that one over there. He eyed the countdown on his HUD. 2 minutes now. 1:59. He yawned. They'd told him it would be easier this time. No seat of the pants improvising. No panic-inducing suffocation. Just a breeze of fresh, cool, anesthetic gas wafting through the helmet reg, putting him gently to sleep before the H2S strangled his very cells from the inside. They know what they're doing. 55 seconds. An icon winked into existence next to the countdown. External camera booting up. Brooks blinked at it and, "Let there be light," Liana whispered over the channel. And there was light. A blinding yellow sun, the size of Brooks's fist held at arm's length, blazing in a black sky. Brooks squinted up against the glare. A jagged sunlit tangle of beams and parallelograms hung overhead, sliced along a dozen angles by sharp-edged fissures of shadow. "Let there be a little less light," he amended, dialing back the brightness. The sun dimmed. The stars came out. They filled the void on all sides, a million bright motes that only managed to accentuate the infinite blackness between them. They disappeared directly overhead, eclipsed where the habs and girders of the crown loomed like a junkyard in the sky. The sun turned the ship's lid edges into a bright jigsaw. The rest was visible only by inference, a haphazard geometry of negative space against the stars. The sky lurched. "Here we go." Another lurch, a sense of slow momentum, building. Somewhere behind them, the ligaments that held the crown together were burning through. Up ahead, the view listed to port. "They know what they're doing." The bow of the ship began to topple, slow and majestic as a falling redwood. Sunlight and shadow played across its facets, hiding and highlighting myriad angles as the stars arced past. The universe turned around them. The sun rose, reached zenith, fell. Something glowed to stern, a corona peeking around a great black shape that blocked out the stars to stern. Something finally tilting into view as a dozen insignificant rags of metal snapped and fell away. Brooks caught the briefest glimpse of dark mass, massive slabs of shielding, a great corrugated trunk thick as a skyscraper. Shock absorbers, he realized. Before a tsunami of white light struck him instantly, rapturously blind. Floaters swarmed through his eyeballs like schools of panicked fish. Brooks blinked away tears, reflexively reached up, felt that strange, newly familiar inertia return to his arms. Free fall, before the sticky mesh released them to let his gloved hands swipe clumsily at his faceplate. He missed. His arms flailed, encountering nothing but the elastic bounce of the G-web. He wobbled gently, weightless, waiting for his vision to clear. By the time he could see again, the panorama had been usurped by mere telemetry. an impoverished wraparound of numbers and contour plots and parabolic trajectories. Brooks squinted, tried to squeeze signal from noise through the cotton growing in his head. The Crown's drive section was already kilometers to port and kilometers ahead, its lead increasing with each second per second. Tactical had laid a vast, attenuate cone of light across the space before it, spreading from the abandoned drive like a searchlight. Ram scoop, Brooks realized after a second. A magnetic field to gather up ionized particles. A break against the solar wind. A proxy for mass gone suddenly missing. No telltale change in acceleration. No suspicious easing back on the throttle. One measure among many, shoehorned in between the masking of heat prints and whatever stealthed this ship to radar. Moore had told him as much as he could understand, Brooks supposed. There would be more. Solutions to problems no baseline could even foresee, let alone solve. A careful, clandestine exit, stage left, while unwitting pursuers followed a bright, burning decoy toward the land of the comets. All spread out across the curve of his own personal diving bell. Numbers and diagrams and stick figure animations for the retarded. He only understood half of it, and didn't know if he could trust the other half. Maybe it's not even real, he thought drowsily. Maybe it's all just a comforting fantasy to keep me pacified in the back seat. Mommy and Daddy, telling nice stories to keep the children from crying. They were still alive, at least. The exhaust hadn't vaporized them outright. Only time would tell if radiation sickness might. Time, or... He cast his eyes around the bubble of intel. He saw nothing that spoke obviously to the subject of gamma rays. It would take a while, of course. You wouldn't feel anything at first. Certainly not in the few minutes left before everyone went down for the... night. 50 days to Icarus. 50 days tumbling ass over entrails. Powered down. Ballistic. Just another piece of inner system junk. Needle in a haystack, maybe, but nowhere near sharp enough to prick anyone who happens to look this way. Lots of time for those bright little shards to rot us out from the inside. We could die in our sleep, and never know it. His eyelids felt incongruously heavy in the weightless compartment. He kept them open, peered around at all those faces under glass, looked for smiles or frowns or any telltale wrinkles of worry that might be creasing more enlightened foreheads. Angles and optics turned half the helmets into warped mirrors, hiding the faces within. Some tiny part of Daniel Brooks furrowed its brow in confusion. Wait a minute. Aren't the lights supposed to be off? But somehow, he could see Liana, eyes already closed, her face smoothed, either in sleep or resignation. He could see the back of Moore's helmet, down past his own boots. He was almost certain that he could make out a pair of bicameral eyes here and there, all closed, the mouths beneath moving in some silent, synchronized chant. Nothing but breathing on calm. Maybe I'm asleep already, he thought, twisting in the web. Maybe I'm lucid. Valerie stared back at him. No trace of fatigue or anesthesia in that face. No metabolic hacks for her, Brooks thought, as his eyes began to close. No rotten stench in the back of her throat. No CO or H2S clogging up her blood cells. No half-assed technology to keep her under. She doesn't need our help. She was doing this 20,000 years ago. She'd mastered the undead arts before we'd even started scratching stick figures on cave walls. She gorged on us, and then she just went away while we bred back to sustainable levels, while we forgot she was real, while we turned her from predator to myth, myth to bedtime story. A bullet hole appeared in the center of her breastplate, a line growing vertically, a crack splitting her suit down the middle. All those years we took to convince ourselves she didn't really exist after all. And all that time she was sleeping right under our feet. Right up until the time she got hungry again and dug herself out of the dirt like some monstrous, godforsaken cicada and went hunting while we put ourselves to sleep in our own graves and called it heaven. Valerie twisted and squirmed and emerged naked from her silvery cocoon. White as a grub, lean as a mantis, she grinned needles and clambered across the web toward him.
Like we're sleeping now, Brooks thought, fading, while she smiles at me.
I am large. I contain multitudes. Walt Whitman. He descended into Heaven's dungeon, but the shackles were empty, and his wife was nowhere to be seen. He lay on his back in the desert, looked down, and saw that he'd been gutted, crotch to throat. Spectral snakes surged eagerly from the gash, fled the confines of his body for the endless baked mud of a fossil seabed. Free at last. Free at last. He soared through an ocean of stars, dimensionless pinpoints, abstract, unchanging, unreal. One of them broke the rules as he watched, a pixel unfolding into higher dimensions like some quantum flower blooming in time-lapse. Angles emerged from outlines. Shadows stretched across surfaces, turning on some axis Brooks couldn't quite make out. Bones spun majestically at its midsection. Monsters in there, waiting for him. He tried to veer off, to break. He pulled all those temporoparietal strings that turned dreams lucid. The crown of thorns continued to swell in his sight, serenely untroubled by his pitiful attempts to rewrite the script. Ahab swept toward him like the head of a mace. He flailed and thrashed and closed his eyes, but felt no impact. When he looked again, he was inside, and Valerie was staring back.
Welcome to heaven, cold cut.
Her monster eyes were fully dilated, like headlights, like balls of bright, bloody glass lit from within. The mouth beneath split open like a fresh, grinning wound.
Go back to sleep, she told him. Forget all your worries. Sleep forever.
Her voice was suddenly, strangely androgynous.
It's your call.
He cried out and opened his eyes. Liana leaned over him. Brooks raised his head, glanced frantically in all directions. Nothing. No one but Liana. They were back in repair and maintenance. Better than storage. He settled back on the pallet. I guess we made it?
Probably.
Probably. His throat was parched. She handed him a squeeze bulb.
We're where we're supposed to be,
she said, as he sucked like a starving newborn.
No obvious signs of pursuit.
It'll take a while before we can be sure, but it's looking good. The drive blew up a few hours after we separated. So as far as we know, they got us. Whoever they are.
Whoever they were.
So, next stop, Icarus?
Depends on you.
Brooks raised his eyebrows.
I mean, yes, we're going to Icarus, but you don't have to be up for it if you're not, you know, up for it. We could put you back under. Next thing you know, you're back on Earth, safe and sound, since you're not officially part of the expedition.
One mission critical, one ballast. Or you put me back under, and I die in my sleep when your expedition goes pear-shaped, he said after a moment. She didn't deny it.
You can die in your sleep anywhere. Besides, the bicams would know better than any of us, and they're pretty sure you'll make it back.
They told you that, did they?
Not explicitly, but yeah. I got that sense from them.
If they really knew what they were going to find down there, Brooks mused, they wouldn't have to go in the first place.
There is that, she said.
And then, more cheerfully,
but if the mission does go pear-shaped, wouldn't you rather die in your sleep than be wide awake and screaming when you get sucked into space?
You are the queen of the silver lining, Brooks told her. She bowed and waited. A trip to the sun. A chance to glimpse the traces of an alien intelligence. Whatever alien meant in a world where members of his own species stitched themselves together into colony minds, or summoned their own worst nightmares back from the Pleistocene to run the stock market. The face of the unknown.
What scientist would choose to sleep through that? As if they'd ever let you get close to their precious angel of the asteroids, his inner companion sneered. As if you'd be able to make any sense of it if they did. Better to sit it out. Better to let them carry you back home so you can pick up your life where you dropped it. You don't belong out here anyway. You're a roach on a battlefield. Who could easily get squashed in his sleep? What soldier in combat, no matter how benign, ever gave a thought to the vermin underfoot? Awake, at least, he might be able to scuttle clear of descending boots. You think I'd pass up the chance to do this kind of field work? He said at last. Liana grinned.
Okay, then. You know the drill. I'll let you get yourself together.
She took a bouncing step toward the ladder. Valerie, Brooks blurted out behind her. She didn't turn. In her hab, with her entourage. When the ship was breaking, I saw. She tilted her head, lowered her gaze to some point on the far bulkhead.
You see weird things when you go under sometimes. Near-death experiences, you know?
Too near. This was no tunnel of light.
Hardly ever is.
Liana reached for the railing. Brain plays tricks on you when you turn it on and off. Can't trust your own perceptions. She paused and turned, one hand on the ladder.
Then again, when can you?
Moore dropped unsmiling onto the deck as Brooks finished pulling on his jumpsuit. He held a personal tent in one hand, a rolled-up cylinder the size of his forearm.
I hear you'll be joining us.
Try to control your enthusiasm.
You're an extra variable, the colonel told him. I have a great deal of work to do, and we may not have the luxury of keeping an eye on you if things get sticky. On the other hand, he shrugged, I can't imagine deciding any differently in your shoes.
Brooks raised his left foot, balanced on his right to scratch at his freshly pinkened ankle. Someone had removed the cast during his latest coma. Believe me, getting in the way's the last thing I want to do. But this isn't exactly familiar territory for me. I don't really know the rules.
Just stay out of the way, basically.
He tossed the tent to Brooks.
You can set up your rack pretty much anywhere you want. The habs are a bit messy. We had to relocate a lot of inventory when they converted the hold. But we've also got fewer people living in them for the time being. So find a spot, set up your tent, buckle down. If you need something, and the interface can't help you, ask Liana. Or me, if I'm not too busy. The bicamerals will be coming out of decompression in a few days. Try to keep out from underfoot. Needless to say, that goes double for the vampire.
What if the vampire wants me underfoot? Moore shook his head.
That's not likely.
She already went out of her way to provoke me.
How exactly?
You see her arm after the spoke broke?
I did not.
She broke it. She broke her own fucking arm. Repeatedly. Said I wasn't setting it right.
But she didn't attack you. Or threaten you.
Not physically. She really seemed to get off on scaring the shit out of me, though. The colonel grunted.
In my experience, those things don't have to try to scare the shit out of anyone. If she wanted you dead or broken, you would be. Vampires have idiomatic speech patterns. You may have simply misunderstood her.
She called me a cold cut.
And Rakshi Sengupta called you a roach. Unless I miss my guess, you took that as an insult, too.
Wasn't it?
Common Tran term. Means so primitive you're unkillable.
I'm plenty killable, Brooks said.
Sure, if someone drops a piano on your head. But you're also field-tested. We've had millions of years to get things right. Some of those folks in the hold are packing augments that didn't even exist a few months ago. First releases can be buggy, and it takes time for the bugs to shake out. And by then, there's probably another upgrade they can't afford to pass up if they want to stay current. So they suffer. Glitches, sometimes. If anything, Roach connotes a bit of envy.
Brooks digested that,
Well, if it was supposed to be some kind of compliment, her delivery needs work. You'd think someone with all that brain power would be able to cobble together a few social skills.
Funny thing. Moore's voice was expressionless. Sengupta can't figure out how someone with all your interpersonal skills could be so shitty at math.
Brooks said nothing.
Don't take this personally, the colonel told him. But try to keep in mind that we're guests on this ship, and your personal standards, whatever they might be, do not reign supreme here. Dogs are always going to come up short if you insist on defining them as a weird kind of cat. These people are not baselines with a tweak here and there. They're closer to separate cognitive subspecies. As far as Valerie goes, she and her bodyguards have pretty much stayed in their hab since the trip began. I expect that to continue. She finds the ambient lighting too bright, for one thing. I doubt you'll have trouble, as long as you don't go looking for any.
Brooks felt his mouth tighten at the corners. So, remembering the briefing in the hub, in the company of the envious Rakshi Sengupta, a week to Icarus?
Closer to 12 days, Moore told him.
Why so long? Moore looked grim.
That fiasco at the monastery. The Crown had to launch prematurely. The set maneuver was always part of the plan. Doesn't take a hive to know a trip like this is going to draw attention. But the replacement drive's still in pieces. They're putting it together as we speak.
Brooks blinked. We've got no engines at all?
Maneuvering thrusters. Can't use them yet. Not without risking detection.
Moore saw the look on Brooks's face, added,
Not that I expect we'll need them in any event. The Hive's ballistic calculations are very accurate. And it's just as well we're taking the long way, given the medical situation. The bug was easy enough to fix once they nailed down its specs, but healing takes time, and hibernation's not the same thing as a medical coma. Last thing we want is to hit the zone with our core personnel compromised.
Moore's face hardened at some grim insight, relaxed again.
My advice? Look on this as an extended sabbatical. Maybe you get a ringside seat to some amazing discoveries. Maybe it's a dead end, and you'll be bored out of your skull. Either way, you can weigh it against a painful death in the Oregon desert and call it a win on points.
He spread his hands.
Here endeth the lesson.
The lights had been dimmed in the northern hemisphere. Climbing into the hub, Brooks could see a wash of arcane tacticals through the equatorial grill, a chromatic mishmash he knew would make no sense, even with an unobstructed view.
Wrong way, said a familiar voice as he headed for the next spoke.
Sengupta.
What?
He couldn't see her, even through the grill. The mirror ball eclipsed the view. But her voice carried clearly around the chamber.
You visiting the vampire?
No. God, no.
Then you're going the wrong way.
Thanks. He second-guessed himself, decided to risk it. Hey, she'd started the conversation. Swam through the air and bullseyed the moving target of the doorway, more through luck than skill. She was still embedded in her acceleration couch, her face turned away as soon as he came into view. She kept up her end, though.
Where are you going?
I don't know. I don't have a clue. Commons. Galley.
Other way. 2 spokes over.
Thanks. She said nothing. Her eyes jiggled in their sockets. Every now and then, a ruby highlight winked off her cornea as some unseen laser read commands there. Meat space display. Brooks tried, after a moment.
What about it?
I thought everyone here used consensus.
This is consensus.
He tapped his temple. I mean, you know, cortical.
Wireless can bite my clit. Anyone can peek.
The fruit of her labor sprawled across a good 20 degrees of the dome, a light storm of numbers and images and, over on the far left side, a stack of something that looked like voice prints. It didn't look like any kind of astrogation display Brooks had ever seen. She was spelunking the cache. I can peek, he said. I'm peeking right now.
Why should I care about you? Sengupta snorted.
Cats and dogs, he thought,
and held his tongue. He tried again. So I guess I've got you to thank for that? Thank for what? He gestured at weeks-old echoes plastered across the sky. Grabbing that snapshot on the way out. Don't know what I'd do for the next 12 days if I didn't have some kind of Quinternet access. Sure, why not? You're eating our food, you're huffing our O2, why not suck our data while you're at it? I give up. He turned and headed back to the exit. He felt Sengupta shift in the couch behind him. I hate that fucking vampire, she moves all wrong. It was nice to know that basic predator aversion subroutines survived the augments, Brooks reflected. And I wouldn't trust Colonel Carnage either, Sengupta added, no matter how much he cozies up to you. He looked back. The pilot floated against the loose restraints of her couch, unmoving, staring straight ahead. Why is that? Brooks asked. Trust him then, do what you want, I don't give a shit. He waited a moment longer. Sengupta sat as still as a stick insect. Thanks, he said at last, and dropped through the floor. So that's what I am then, a parasite. He descended into the lab. Some half-dead fossil scooped up in passing from the battlefield, patched together for no better reason than the firing of a few mirror neurons, some vestigial itch we might have once called pity. The equipment wasn't his, but the workbench provided some degree of plastic comfort, a bit of surrogate familiarity in a ship too full of long bones and strange creatures. Worse than ballast, I suck their O2 and eat their supplies and take up precious airspace millions of clicks from the nearest real atmosphere. Less than a pet, they don't want my company, feel no urge to scritch my ears, aren't interested in any tricks I might know except staying invisible and playing dead. Sequence/splicer. Universal incubator. Optoelectron nanoscope with a respectable 30 picometer threshold. All reassuringly familiar in a world where he'd half expected the very dust to be built out of miracles and magic crystals. Maybe that was deliberate. A security blanket for strays who'd missed the singularity. Okay then, I'm a parasite. Parasites are not destroyed by the powerful. Parasites feed on them. Parasites use the powerful to their own ends. The lower level was empty except for a short stack of folded chairs and half-dozen cargo cubes, fab matter stockpiles, according to the manifest. Brooks unslung the tent and spread it across the deck against a curve of bulkhead. A tapeworm may not be as smart as its host, but that doesn't stop it from scamming shelter and nourishment and a place to breed. Good parasites are invisible. The best are indispensable. Gut bacteria, chloroplasts, mitochondria. All parasites once. All invisible in the shadow of vaster beings. Now their hosts can't live without them. The structure inflated into a kind of bulbous lozenge. It swelled igloo-like toward the center of the compartment, molded itself against the walls and flooring behind. It wasn't too different from his abandoned tent back in the desert. The piezoelectricity that buttressed the structure also powered the GUI sheathing its inner surface. Brooks ran an index finger down the center of the door. Its membranous halves snapped gently apart like a sheet of mesentery split down the middle. Some go even farther. Some get the upper hand, dig down, and change the wiring right at the synapse. Dicrocelium, saculina, toxoplasma. Brainless things, all of them. Mindless creatures that turn inconceivably greater intellects into puppets. He dropped to his knees and crawled inside. The built-in hammock clung to the inner surface of the tent, ready to peel free and inflate at a touch. The default config only provided enough headroom for a crouch, but Brooks couldn't be bothered to dial up the headroom. Besides, the tight confines were strangely comforting down here at the very bottom of the spoke. Just a few layers of alloy and insulation from the whole starry drum of the heavens rolling past beneath his feet. So I'm a parasite? Fine. It is an honorable title. Down here, nestled in this warm and self-regulating little structure, he He was as heavy as the crown would let him be. He felt almost stable, almost rooted. And while he wouldn't quite call it safety, he almost managed not to notice how like a burrow his quarters were, how deep in the earth, how far removed from other inhabitants of this pocket ecosystem, and how Daniel Brooks, huddled against the deck like a mouse, squeezed into the farthest corner of a great glass terrarium full of cobras, the lights turned up as bright as they would go. If you are given a choice, you believe you have acted freely. Raymond Teller. Every Hab started out like every other. Same standalone life support, same snap-and-stretch frame guides to subdivide the living space to personal preference, same basic bulkhead galley panel with a toilet on the other side. They all came with the same emergency hive hookups, compatible with most popular pressure suits and long-distance coffins, not included. It was Boeing's most generic all-purpose personarium, plucked off the shelf, bought in bulk, stuck on the ends of the crown's spokes on short notice, in the almost inconceivable event that one of those spokes should snap and send a hab tumbling off on its own. Corporate guarantees ensured that the bodies therein would keep fresh and breathing, if inert, for up to a year, or until atmospheric reentry, whichever came first. Which was not to say that custom features were out of the question. The Faber and Commons could whip up food with actual taste. Moore was the only other warm body in evidence when Brooks climbed down for breakfast. The colonel didn't return the other man's smile at first. Brooks recognized the thousand-meter stare of the consensist. But the sound of Brooks' feet on the deck brought him back to the impoverished world of mere meat space.
"Daniel,"
he said. "Didn't mean to disturb you," Brooks said, which was a lie. He'd waited until the sparse constellations arrayed across the crown's intercom had aligned just so. Liana or Moore in the commons, Valerie anywhere else, before venturing forth in search of forage. Moore waved the apology away.
"I could do with a break anyway."
Brooks told the Faber to print him up a plate of French toast and bacon. Break from what?
"Theseus telemetry,"
Moore told him.
"What little there is of it. Brushing up for the main event."
"There's a main event? For us?"
"How do you mean?"
Brooks one-handed his meal to the commons table. Petroleum accents faintly adulterated the aroma of syrup and butter rising from the plate, and sat down. "Dwarves among giants, right? I didn't get the sense there'd be any kind of active role for mere baselines." He tried a strip of bacon. "Not bad."
"They have their reasons for being here," Moore said mildly. "I have mine,"
in a tone that said, "and they're not for sharing."
"You deal with these guys a lot," Brooks guessed.
"These guys?"
"Bicams. Post-humans."
"They're not post-human. Not yet."
"How can you tell?" It was only half a joke.
"Because otherwise, we wouldn't be able to talk to them at all."
Brooks swallowed a bolus of faux French toast. "They could talk to us. Some of them, anyway."
"Why would they bother? We're on the verge of losing them as it is. And do you have children, Daniel?"
He shook his head. "You?"
"A son. Ciri's not exactly baseline himself, actually. Nowhere near the far shore. But even so, it's been difficult to connect sometimes. And maybe this comparison won't mean much to you, but they're all our children. Humanity's children. And even now we can barely keep their interest. Once they tip over that edge..."
He shrugged.
"How long would it take you to decide you had better things to do than talk to a bunch of Capuchins?"
"They're not gods," Brooks reminded him softly.
"Not yet."
"Not ever."
"That's denial."
"Better than genuflection." Moore smiled, a bit ruefully.
"Come on, Daniel. You know how powerful science can be. 1,000 years to climb from ghosts and magic to technology. 1.5 days from technology back up to ghosts and magic."
I thought they didn't use science, Brooks said. I thought that was the whole point. Moore granted it with a small nod.
Either way, you put baselines against bicamerals, and the bicamerals are going to be 100 steps ahead every time.
And you're comfortable with that?
My comfort doesn't enter into it. Just the way it is.
You seem so fatalistic about it all. Brooks pushed his empty plate aside. The far shore, the gulf between giants and Capuchins.
Not fatalism,
Moore corrected him.
Faith.
Brooks glanced sharply across the table, trying to decide if Moore was yanking his chain. The soldier stared back impassively. The fact that something shot us, Brooks continued deliberately, and you yourself said they're probably Tran.
I did, didn't I?
Moore seemed to find that amusing.
Fortunately, we've got a pretty good team of those in our own corner. Honestly, I wouldn't worry.
You trust them too much, Brooks said quietly.
So you keep saying. You don't know them the way I do.
You think you know them? You're the one who called them giants. We don't know their agendas any more than we know what those smart clouds are up to. At least smart clouds don't open up your brain and dig around like... Moore didn't say anything for a moment. Then...
Liana.
You know what they did to her?
Not exactly.
That's exactly my point. No one does. Liana doesn't know. They shut her off for 4 days, and when she woke up, she was some kind of Chinese room savant. Who knows what they did to her brain? Who knows if she's the same person?
She's not,
Moore said flatly.
Change the wiring, change the machine.
That's what I'm saying.
She agreed to it. She volunteered. She worked her ass off and elbowed her way to the front of the line just for the chance to make the cut.
It's not informed consent. That raised eyebrow again.
How so?
How can it be, when the person giving it is cognitively incapable of understanding what she's agreeing to?
So you're saying she's mentally incompetent, Moore said.
I'm saying we all are, next to the hives and the vampires and the thumb wirers and that whole...
We're children.
Yes.
Who can't be trusted to make our own decisions.
Brooks shook his head. Not about things like this, no.
We need adults to make those choices on our behalf.
He fell silent. Moore watched him above the ghost of a smile. After a moment, he pulled the Glenmorangie off the wall.
Have a drink,
he said.
Helps the future go down easier.
Crawling unseen through the viscera of its host, the parasite takes control. Daniel Brooks drilled into the central nervous system of the Crown of Thorns and bent it to his will. Liana, as usual, was back in the hold with her helpless omnipotent masters. Sengupta's icon glowed in the hub. Moore was ostensibly in the dorm, but the feed from that hab put the lie to it. Only his body was there, running on autopilot, while his closed eyes danced through some consensual realm Brooks could only imagine. He was going to be eating alone. The anxiety had become chronic by now. It nagged at the bottom of his brain like a toothache, had become so much a part of him that it went unnoticed, save for those times when some unexpected chill brought it all back. Panic attacks, in the spokes, in the habs, in his own goddamn tent. They didn't happen often, and they never lasted long. Just often enough to remind him, just long enough to keep him paranoid. The blade began to twist as he ascended the spoke. Brooks gritted his teeth, briefly closed his eyes as the conveyor pulled him past the zone of terror. It helped. Really, it did. Relaxed as the haunted zone receded beneath him. He released the handhold at the top of the spoke and coasted into the hub, crossed the Antarctic hatch, half contracted now, barely wide enough for the passage of a body. Pushed himself toward a soft, wet sound, a cough from the northern hemisphere, a broken breath, someone crying. Sengupta was up there. Had been a few minutes ago, at least. He cleared his throat. Hello? A brief rustle. Silence and ventilators. Okay. He resumed his course, crossed to the commons spoke, twisted and jackknifed through. He allowed himself a moment of self-congratulation as he grabbed the conveyor and started down headfirst, smoothly swinging around the handhold until his feet pointed down. Just 2 days ago, all these drain pipes and variable gravity straightaways would have left him completely disoriented. Valerie tagged him halfway. He never saw her coming. He had his face to the bulkhead. There may have been a flicker of overhead shadow, just a split second before that brief touch between his shoulder blades, like a knife's edge sliding along his spine, like being unzipped down the back. His back brain reacted before he was even aware of the contact, flattened and froze him like a startled rabbit. By the time he could move again, she was past and gone, and Daniel Brooks was still alive. He looked down, down that long tunnel she'd sailed headfirst and without a sound. She was waiting at the bottom of the spoke, white and naked and almost skeletal, wiry corded muscle stretched over bone. Her right foot tapped a strange and disquieting pattern on the metal. The conveyor was delivering him into her arms. He released the handhold, lunged against the spoke for the static safety of the ladder. He missed the first rung he grabbed for, caught the second. Leftover momentum nearly popped his shoulder from its socket. His feet scrabbled for purchase, finally found it. He clung to the ladder as the conveyor streamed past to each side, going up, going down. Valerie looked up at him. He looked away. She just touched me, for Christ's sake. I barely even felt it. It was probably an accident. No accident. She hasn't threatened you. She hasn't raised a hand. She's just sitting there, waiting. Not in her hab, not kept at bay by bright lights, no matter what comforting lies Moore had recited. Brooks kept his eyes on the bulkhead. He swore he could feel the baring of her teeth. She's just another failed hominoid, that's all she is. Without our drugs, she couldn't even handle a few right angles without going into convulsions. Just another one of nature's fuck-ups. Just another extinct monster 10,000 years dead. And brought back to life. And chillingly, completely at home in the future. More at home than Daniel Brooks had ever felt. She wouldn't even be alive if it weren't for us. If we roaches hadn't scraped up all those leftover genes and spliced them back together again. She had her day. She's nothing to be afraid of. Don't be such a fucking coward. Coming? With effort, he looked down, managed to fix his gaze on the edge of the hatch behind her, kept her eyes in that great comforting wash of low resolution that made up 95% of the human visual field. He even managed to answer, after a fashion. His hands stayed locked on the ladder. Suit yourself, Valerie said, and disappeared into the commons.